Hey guys, just before we start the show, a quick note. I was actually featured on the Right to Reason podcast with our friend Robert Stanley, and we actually did a debate, me versus Dale Glover. We had a great time doing this about the historicity of Jesus, a debate on mythicism. So if you want to find out more about Kevin's wacky adventures, you go check that out at the Right to Reason.
Hey there, heathens! I'm John, the Godless Engineer.
Hi, I'm Aaron Rod.
Hi, this is Andrew Jasko.
This is Don Queen from the Godless Heathens Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Hector Garcia.
Hi, this is Owen from Rex and Owen and the Skeptical Texan.
Hey, I'm Stephen Woodford of Rationality Rose.
Hi, I'm Thomas Westbrook of Holy Kool-Aid.
Hi, this is Matt Delahunty.
Hi, this is Brent and Nikki from Unapologetics.
Hi, I'm Donald Trump, and I took a rip. Wait, which one second? I gotta put my hands up here.
Just go ahead, Robert. Just go.
Hi, I'm Robert Stanley of the Right to Reason podcast, and I took a left at the valley.
And we. Oh, should I say it too? No,
sure.
I know we shouldn't have to scream that we're atheists. You know, we don't have non-astrologers and all that. But with the religious people taking over the world, I mean, we can either speak up or be pushed into a corner.
I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen. I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith. And unsubstantiated claims, that's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist.
Coming at you from the end of the summer, this is Left Out of Valley. My name is Kevin, and people who wear glasses must be excited about next year. They get to see 2020.
I wish.
The eye roll. Joining me as usual is a team who will tell you that an opinion without 3.1416 is just an onion. Think about that one.
Yep.
The devil whispered to her, I'm coming for you. And she whispered back, bring pizza. Nancy.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Pizza goes good with everything. And with the devil, hoo-ha.
She took the wrong medication, but on the positive side, she's protected from heartworms and fleas. Christina.
Hey, gotta protect from everything.
And she saw a dwarf coming down the prison wall, and she thought it was a little condescending. Kirsten.
Oh, my God.
Ladies, welcome back. Hope you had a great week.
Where do you find those?
Don't ask.
I mean, how do you... What kind of search... I mean, as someone who searches for information to do my segments, I'd like to know, where do you... I never see any of these.
You don't want a one-trip way into my mind.
Not to rat them out, but I've seen almost every single one of those on Facebook in the last couple weeks.
A lot of them are on Facebook. Yeah, that's true.
Well, I've got to expand my search capabilities, that's for sure.
So today we'll be talking to Dale Unnath, and we'll be talking about... evidence-based eating, so that should be very interesting. But that's going to be in the second half of the show. But first, let's do a usual chit-chat. Have you guys heard that the Israeli government has been, of course, they've been controversial in the treatment of Palestinians, but...
Yeah, just slightly.
Very slightly. Did you guys hear that Hydro-Québec, right here in Canada, declined to renew an agreement with them with the Israel Electric Corporation over the concerns about Palestine?
Good.
Yeah.
No.
So, the IEC is accused of helping the Israeli government in violating the human rights of the Palestinians. And basically, the Hydro-Québec decided to put their money where their mouth is and say, no, you know, we're not doing business with you guys anymore.
That's fantastic.
So, I think that's the way to go. And hopefully, maybe we'll see other companies put more financial pressure like that on the Israeli government.
Because they're literally murdering them.
Yeah.
Like, that is not okay.
No, absolutely not. Did you guys also hear that apparently students, Jenny Yao and Miranda Wang, the two students, that they developed a bacterium capable of eating plastic?
Seriously?
Yeah. I did hear about that.
Yeah, I only saw the headline, so...
Yeah, they've obtained a patent, and they've actually managed to secure $400,000 in financing. This bacterium would dissolve plastic into CO2 and water. So first they dissolve the plastic, and then when it's malleable, they put it in a biodigester station, and it's all done within 24 hours.
That's amazing.
Wow.
That is really, really promising.
Is it drinkable water?
I'm assuming so.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Have you noticed lately, and I'm sort of making this up, but there's a range here that's important. Have you noticed that, let's say, 7 out of 10 new inventions are being made or research by teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, under because 21. They're the ones
it
that are like
8 out of 10. But the, lately, anytime you look at something that's, you know,
it's a lot.
Come on, it's someone under 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think it's because they're the generation that is like, we're effed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We have to solve these problems or I'm not going to see 30.
Exactly, exactly. They take things like climate change very seriously because they're realizing the older generations are not.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, we need to tackle this, and they are now waiting for the adults, quote unquote, to
the
do it.
The older generations don't even think it's real most exactly. of the time.
Yeah, I think part of it may be that when a 15 or 16 year old gets an idea and they get obsessed by it, they can do it. They don't have to wait for a CEO
mm-hmm.
or for a human resources person to say, no, this isn't in your department, that's in that department. They go ahead and do it, and they're allowed to fail and do it over and over without somebody saying, no, you've put enough time in this. I really think it's the freedom to invent and to be creative.
Yeah, yeah. As Neil deGrasse Tyson said, we're all born natural scientists until it's beaten out of us.
Yeah.
With time and, you know, life, essentially. You know, you have to worry about making ends meet instead. But when you're at that age, you know, they actually tackle on it. They've got probably more imagination than the rest of us do. So they just tackle the problem, and hooray for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you guys hear that Canadians, through a crowdfunding, raised $3 million to buy a stretch of coastal BC right here? This is 2,000 acres of Princess Louisa Inlet on the Sunshine Coast to protect it from loggers and developers.
I didn't hear about this.
I didn't hear about
this. Yeah, so they decided to buy land because the land of some loggers and developers want to use it, obviously, and to build houses and take off the trees and all that stuff. The average donation was apparently between $10 and $20. And they managed to raise $3 million to protect that little...
Good for them.
Yeah, excellent. And hopefully this is a kind of the thing that catches on and keeps going. And last but not least, Iceland. And that's a progressive nation.
I love this story.
And, of course, who comes to visit Iceland? Well, enter Mike Pence.
You know, I hate him.
The vice president. He's a known homophobe and anti-LGBT advocate. So he traveled, and on his visit to Iceland I'm pronouncing this right, Reykjavik. Oh, thank
Reykjavik.
You. Reykjavik. Well, he had a meeting with the president, Johansson, and was greeted with rows of pride flags.
Mm-hmm.
A whole bunch of pride flags.
Oh, the beauty of it.
And
I know.
The president and his first lady also were wearing pride bracelets.
Yeah, good.
Oh, fuck. Yes.
Yeah. That was just beautiful to watch that.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. I would have loved to have been the proverbial fly on the wall for that one.
I would have loved to see
it's really
face.
Interesting because it started, I'm pretty sure it started with one business that was right next to the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just caught on, and then everybody put the flag up.
Do you, I don't know. I don't know much about the intelligence of Mike Pence. And I know a lot of atheists think
there
that,
isn't, you know, much to know about.
Okay, fair enough. A lot of atheists have a tendency to think that if Trump was impeached, it'd be even worse for us atheists because Pence is a bit much of a, you know, Christian crusader. But you know, I'm looking at the pictures. I don't even know if this guy realized it. You know, from his vacant expression, he doesn't even look like he realized what was happening. I don't know.
I think he's a person that if you agree with his core values, and he knows it, you can manipulate him to do almost anything, you know, in saying, we're going to accomplish your, you know, anti-LGBTQ agenda, and all you have to do is this. He's in,
mm-hmm.
you know. He just, I don't think he thinks for himself.
No. I think he's, I always get the impression he's a yes man. You know?
He's a toady.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, well, thank you so much for that. Well, in the meantime, we got some...
Yay! I hope they like us.
So this is from a listener called Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
She says, I've reached out to you in the last week, and you said if I needed help, so I just wanted to share a thought. I listened to some atheist experience today, and a woman, theist, was having a discussion with Matt, and she was explaining his reasons for no heaven. She started to cry because she could see how thoroughly he set out his explanation and how it sounded more reasonable to her than what she's been taught all her life. He was so careful and caring, and she said, She said what that her sister had died when she, the theist, was 13, and she looked forward to seeing her again in heaven. It was killing her that it might not be true as she hoped. Kevin, I cried for her. I'm still bloody crying because it's not fair that she's so hurt because of a fairy story. Anyway, thanks for listening. I might have messed up sending this. My apologies, blah, blah, blah. I wanted to quickly address this, and I think we should. The thing about atheism is it's not emotionally comfortable. And I'll be the first one to admit that I like the idea of an afterlife. I do. And, you know, a part of me would actually almost be relieved to realize once I check out that I wake up somewhere else. But the thing is, being an atheist also means that you've chosen intellectual honesty over emotional comfort. Now, there could be an afterlife, but the thing is we have nothing that actually points to it. So, I don't want to be a hard atheist, because some people are, and I think they're making a mistake when they say, no, there is no such thing. Because we don't really know. But for what we do know, there is nothing that points to this. And as uncomfortable as it is, and I think it's one of the kind of flaws of the fact of being an atheist, it's not appealing for a lot of people, because we are emotional creatures. And we have a tendency to, you know, we want to be comforted. And as atheists, you know, I think it takes a lot of courage for us to admit that, you know, like I said, we're intellectually honest and say, we have no reason to actually think that. Does that make any sense to you guys?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the rational way to think about it, but the emotional hole that leaves, a person can be inconsolable because of it. Yeah. So I guess the question is, what do you do? Do you tell that person, this is what science and evidence tells us, but if it gives you comfort to believe that at this point in your life, and it helps you, even though you know it may not be true, if it gives you emotional comfort where you can leave this world in peace and not in a state of turmoil because you think you're never going to ever see the people that you loved in this world that passed away, is there harm in saying, if that's what gives you, knowing that it may not be true, but if it gives you comfort knowing that, is that so bad?
I actually think it in some ways is, because how I look at it, because when I was still a Christian, the afterlife was something that gave me both a lot of, like, excitement, but also terror, because I grew up in a family where we believed in the very real, literal place of hell. And I was terrified that everyone I loved would go to hell, especially when my twin sister wasn't a Christian. And I had to live with, like, I had to go through my day being like, this person I love is going to be tortured for eternity. Like, how is that okay? And for people who lose someone close to them and that they love, and that they then are like, I'll see them again in heaven, it almost puts a stop on grieving. And it keeps you from really processing those emotions of this person is gone, because it almost tricks your mind into like, oh, they're on vacation. Oh, it's like makes you be in the same spot as this person is living in Australia now and I won't see them for a long time. Where when you realize, because I personally have zero belief in even a soul. Like, I'm very much like, who we are is directly in our body. And that there's nothing that continues on that is us. So for me, death is comforting. Because, like, there isn't anything like that. Once you die, like, you don't have to worry, because their existence is over, and they aren't going to suffer. They aren't going to have, like, there's nothing. And, like, for people who come from a place where they expect this wonderful existence afterwards, it can be a really hard transition to realize that won't be there.
Personally, I think that deep down inside, we all know there is nothing after. You know, if you're a Christian and you truly, truly believe that, you know, you just, this is the temporary living and after that you get to go to heaven, why would you cry at somebody's funeral? You'd be happy for them. You know, you say, you know, you're gone now, my friend, I will see you when I'm joining you. But people cry all the time because I think deep down inside we know. We actually know that this person is gone and gone.
I don't actually agree with that.
I'm just saying on an instinctual level. Yeah. On an instinctual level, I think we this is why we grieve, because we understand that no, this person is not coming back.
Well, but there are people who do celebrate the death.
Oh yeah, but they're few and far between. And they don't the average person
the grief, which is something that Christina was saying a few minutes ago, that you don't finish the
and
process.
A lot of times at those funerals where they're crying, it's not the same level of grief. It 'cause when people are at the airport wishing their loved one goodbye, they're sometimes bawling their eyes out because they won't see that person for 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, I'll see you again.
Yeah.
So when you're at a funeral in a religious sense, a lot of people are grieving the time that it'll take to see them again.
I just, this is, like I said, it's my personal opinion. It's only worth that much. But like I said, I just get the impression that deep down, we all know. And this is why the priest has to go up front and say, no, don't worry about Bob. He's not dead. He's actually playing ball with Jesus right now. He's happy. You know, because I think deep down inside, you know, the priest, we kind of like to lie to ourselves to try to make ourselves feel better about something like that. And to answer your question, Nancy, if a person has a belief that, you know, they have an afterlife, is that such a bad thing? If it was just a belief of an afterlife in itself, no. But if you take the version of, let's say, Christianity, for example, or Islam, it's not just a belief in itself. It comes with a caveat of everything else that's around it, and that is what's dangerous. If for a person to say, for example, you just go back to the universe and they have some kind of woo thing, sure, that's not going to harm. By all means, go ahead and believe that, because it's not going to actually influence much of your actions on the planet. But when you believe that, no, Jesus is here and he's going to collect me, but at the same time you start thinking, oh well, yeah, but Jesus also said this, you know, the homosexuality is an abomination and blah blah blah, there's more to the religion than just the afterlife
belief. Well, and that's, I find, sometimes where you get people doing horrible things is that they think to get that ultimate reward and that afterlife that's happy, they need to do these horrible things. They need to do what their quote unquote God said, so that they can have that justification internally, being like, to get this happy end, I need to do this thing because that's what's asked of me.
Yeah.
Where without religion, you don't really get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but confining the discussion to what Kathy's talking about in terms of just the reunion with, I'm wondering whether or not if it was possible to have a discussion with that person she was listening to, and you said to her, if you knew without a doubt that there was nothing after life, that this is all we have, but you love your sister, would there be anything else that would give you comfort other than knowing there was an afterlife where you would meet up? If you knew absolutely that that was not possible, what else might give you comfort? And I wonder what answers people would give if they'd say, well, there isn't anything else. Or they'd start to think, well, I've had her, you know, I've been able to have her, you know, alive and in my heart all of these years. And the fact that we were, you know, together, and that she had a good life, and that we enjoyed all these experiences, maybe, you know, that's enough of a comfort. And then to take whatever comes after that. I mean, maybe that's a question. I mean, this certainly is something. That's an interesting.
Oh, it's a huge topic.
I also think,
because I don't think there's a definitive answer for everybody. There's not a, you know, one heaven fits all kind of a
And
umbrella.
I definitely think that how Kathy is feeling about this woman, because she was saying how, like, she's crying for her.
Yeah, there's a lot of empathy.
And I think that is totally normal.
Yeah.
Because this woman is, when she was 13, she lost someone she loved. And depending on what kind of family she was in, she might not have got any grief support. It might have been, oh, just be happy for them. So all of those feelings might have been bottled up. and separated. And then she's coming to a now realization that she has to face those feelings.
So then
that could definitely be one of the reasons she's crying, being like, I have to grieve now.
So Kathy, thank you so much for your letter. But just remember two quotes. One from Neil deGrasse Tyson basically said, or was it Richard Dawkins that basically said, you know, we are the universe made conscious and aware of itself, and for that we are the lucky ones. You know, what makes life so precious is the finite amount of it, the finality of it, and that's what makes it precious. And that's why Christians have a tendency to treat this life like it's just a somewhere they can wipe their feet for the next one, not realizing this might be the only one. And also Ricky Gervais basically said, you know, people say that atheists have nothing to live for. No, we have nothing to die for.
Exactly.
You know, we have everything to live for because we think this is the only one. And from what we can tell, it really is the only life you have. So make it as beautiful as possible for the short amount of time we are here. All right. Anyway, thank you so much, Kathy.
I hope that answered your question.
I sure hope it did.
Yeah.
All right.
Kathy, let us know if you want the discussion to go on again. Let us know if there's another aspect of it. And thank you so much for sharing that question with us and allowing us to hopefully give you a good answer.
All right. My dear Nancy, you got a top 10 for us?
I do. You have no doubt that I would have.
Oh, of course not. I have no doubt. No doubt about you whatsoever.
Okay, and this one you got to help me out with, Kevin, because today's top 10, you inspired.
Oh.
And so, I'm putting the burden on you, because this one to me is like another talking to Dr. Ben.
Okay.
And what it is 10 old school cars that you need in your garage because they're muscle cars.
Okay.
Remember asking me about the muscle cars?
I did.
Okay. All right. Great. So we're going to talk about muscle cars today. And for those of us that don't know or need a little review, let's answer the question, what is a muscle car? And then we'll go on to the top 10. A muscle car is considered to be a more compact yet heavy two-door car, which is powered by a large displacement engine and is focused on performance. Good so far? Okay. Generally, muscle cars feature a 2+2 design, whatever that is, with a small rear seat in a coupe format, but the modern-day Dodge Charger would be the sedan exception in the muscle car world. You agree with that?
I think so. This is a good description.
Okay, muscle car
started... It's not a Toyota Corolla.
Okay. muscle car started... When do you think they started?
In the 60s.
1949. They go.
I was going to say 50s.
Yeah. And the muscle car that we can trace back to 1949 is the Oldsmobile Rocket 88.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a little debate about that, but there are a lot of contenders claim, you know, yes or no, but generally, you know, we can take that one as the muscle car. Why did they stop? As time went on and the world experienced a few oil crises and higher gas prices, as well as stricter exhaust emissions and higher insurance premiums, the muscle cars slowly faded away. And it wasn't until the mid to late 2000s that muscle cars came back in full force. Okie dokie. So here we go with the muscle cars. Number 10, 1969 Chevrolet Camaro ZL1.
Anybody know about that one?
Yes. Nope.
Do you know about that one?
I came very close to having one myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't quite have it because I was young and didn't quite have the money and anyway, circumstances. But mine was a special edition on top of that. It had the round Corvette lights in the back instead of the strips that they usually have. It's a nice, nice car.
Yeah, they said that it's the most powerful engine that was offered by Chevrolet by the public, and it was also a rare car, believe it or not. So they had, I don't know how many that they put out, but there wasn't a whole lot of them. So
no.
they were rare at that time, and I don't know how many there are available now or have been restored in people's garages. But that's supposed to be, and it didn't have a specific emblem of just the usual Camaro badge. So that's number 10. Number 9, the 1970 Buick GSX. What do you think about that one?
Well, I'd probably have to take a good look at it because myself, I never thought of Buick as a muscle car
thing. That's what I thought.
Especially in those years.
I'm like, a Buick?
I know, it was a luxurious car, and yet, and a Buick, so... Yeah.
My friend had one, and the seats were like fucking clouds. It was amazing.
It was like daddy's car, right? The Buick, the big Buick, it was a comfortable
ride.
The
boat car.
The boat car. Little-known fact, Buick, the brand Buick, is highly, highly praised in China.
Really? Mm.
To this day. Here, people say, oh, wow, have you seen this Ferrari? Over there is, wow, have you seen that Buick?
Wow.
Yeah.
This Buick, because it was daddy's car and it was such a solid, middle class kind, there were only 687 of these GSX, another rare
car.
Yeah.
So it's not just muscle cars, it's rare muscle cars.
It's a rare muscle car. I have no idea how much you'd have to pay for any of these cars at this point. I guess it depends on the condition and how much needs and whether parts are available and all that good stuff. Number eight. The 1970 Dodge Challenger.
Oh, of course.
Was that kind of a standard?
Well, they've remade the Challenger today, right? Which was pretty much the nostalgia factor right there.
I haven't seen them around in a while, actually.
What, the Challengers? They're all over the place.
Yeah. I've seen the Chargers, but not the Challengers.
Oh, I think there's even more Challengers other than the Chargers right now.
Really?
It's built on
the Plymouth Barracuda platform, so it was
the Barracuda.
Yeah, it wasn't as rare as a lot of the other cars, but back then the Dodges were.
Oh yeah, everything in Mopar back then was
Yeah. So the number seven is a 1968 Plymouth Roadrunner Hemi.
Yes.
Oh, you're nodding on that one. What do you know about that one?
Well, as soon as you see Hemi, the Hemi refers to a hemisphere, which is the shape of the chamber where the spark happens, actually the combustion chamber inside. So it's a hemisphere, and these engines, the 426 Hemi, the 427 Hemi, they're legendary engines, actually.
It was a 425 horsepower,
yeah, very, very powerful
cubic engine.
I had an acquaintance in Quebec that actually had a 426 Hemi in parts that was sitting in oil, and this is like 20 years ago. He was offered $50,000 for it, and he said no.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Why the hell did he say no?
Because that engine is right now is probably worth double, if triple.
Wow. Weren't they the super drag racing?
They were powerful. This is the kind of car that, you sat in and you put a dollar in the dashboard, and as soon as you floored that, you almost had to struggle to reach to grab that dollar on the dashboard. It just pushed you right back. It was just pure power.
Yeah, they thought they'd sell 20,000 of when they came out, and they ended up doubling it. There were about 40,000, at the time. Number six, Mercury Cougar Eliminator. Mm. Like the name.
Okay.
It's quite the name.
Yeah, it is quite the name. Mercury tried to raise their profile with muscle cars. So in 1969, they did the Cougar, and it was 355 horsepower, 440 pounds of torque, and they had headers. They could put headers in them and dual quad carburetors and all that. So they tricked them out pretty well, I guess, didn't they? Were they as popular? Was the Mercury as popular as
Mercury was at the time, for people that are young might not know, was the more luxurious version of Ford. Mm. They stopped making the Mercury. A bit like Pontiac was a more luxurious version of Chevrolet.
Right? Yeah.
It was made by the same thing. You had the Ford Mustang, and you had the Mercury. Oh God, what was it called? The Mercury Capri. It was a Mustang, but it was just a bit more toys to it, and more bells and whistles.
Yeah, it came in four really cool colors: white, that's not so cool, yellow, white, bright blue, and I like this competition orange.
Mm. Ooh.
Ooh, yeah. So, pretty cool car all the way around. Number five, a 1970 Oldsmobile 442.
Yes.
Oh, now you're brightening up for that one.
Yes. The 442, for you movie buffs, you ever seen the movie Demolition Man?
Yes. Yeah.
That car, that old car he gets in there, the black and red car, that's the 442.
Oh, nice.
That's a beautiful, beautiful car. That'd be like one of my favorites by far, too.
Well, people thought that was the king of the performance muscle cars, and it had a standard 445 CID V8 engine, and General Motors said it was a 365 horsepower, but it probably was up to about 400 horsepower, accompanied by a raucous, and I'm reading this off the page, a raucous 500 pound-feet torque.
Mm.
So it was a
500 pound-feet torque is the kind of torque Porsches have today.
Yeah. They,
so.
Yeah.
They, that's how much grip that thing had.
Yeah, that was quite.
But that was back
quite
then.
The car. James Garner, the actor, took a 1970 Olds to the NORRA Mexico 1000 race, which later became the Baja 1000, and won second place with that car.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, he was a pretty good race car. He enjoyed race car. A lot of actors did. Paul Newman enjoyed it as well, but I guess this was a favorite of James Garner. Number four, 1970 Ford Torino Cobra.
Oh, okay.
Ford got into the game here.
Yeah, yeah.
With everything else. It had different models, but the one that everybody considers their favorites was the Cobra. It's a performance model. It was a Motor Trend Car of the Year in 1970, so it got a number of accolades, and people really liked it. They had 15-inch Magnum wheels and black sports slats, and really cool car. It was 370 horsepower with a 420 V8 engine. It was a little heavier, but it was really beautiful car. A lot of people loved it. Number three, 1968 Shelby Mustang GT 500 KR.
Yes, we
got a big designation on that one. So what do we all know about that?
Anything that's Shelby is essentially pretty much legendary. If you see a car and it's got those two white stripes on the middle, that's a Shelby look, right?
Is Carroll Shelby still
alive? No, he's not.
Yeah.
He's not. I happen to know a gentleman right here, not far, right here in Rosedale, who's got two Ford Mustangs. I believe a 1967 Boss, I think, 302, and both of them are just like in the garage, just sitting in the heat, and they're just sitting there, and both of them are actually signed by Shelby himself.
Oh, wow.
He used to have three. He sold one. It's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? This is worth a fortune right there.
Oh, man. Well, the KR on that, 500 KR stood for King of the Road.
Mm.
Yeah, so I don't know whether everybody knows that or that's a little trivia, but there's a little trivia that any car buff can pull out, thanks to Left at the Valley. So it was the King of the Road. They had a 428 engine known as the Cobra Jet, and that gave the horsepower out, gave the car a horsepower outlet of 335 and a total torque of 448. So it was a really neat car, and it was Shelby, so had a lot going for it. So we're heading down to the final two. Any guesses as to what the final two might be? You don't have to go for the order, but any guesses?
I'll go for a 1970 Charger with a soft top.
Wish it was.
No.
Gave you a second there to think about it, but number two is a 1964 Plymouth. Now, this is only one list, so it could have made another list, pretty easy. But on this list, the number two is a 1964 Plymouth Belvedere. You remember the Belvedere?
Really? Yeah. Belvedere.
Yeah, and it didn't look like a muscle car, and yet it was a really powerful car, and it was, although it was very light, it had a 426 Hemi engine, and it was a real, according to a lot of people, it was a real beast on the drag strip, and they did very well by adding a Hemi engine. And
They don't look like muscle cars at all. They kind of look like a Buick.
The Belvedere won first, second, and third at NASCAR's 1964 Daytona race, believe it or not. So that's why it made the number two. Yeah, it was a... I guess you didn't, when you looked at it, you didn't realize the power under the hood.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Looks can be deceiving. Okay, here we go. Number one is, the 1968 Dodge Dart 426 Hemi. Does that ring
really?
Any bells?
The Dart?
According to this list, one of the best muscle cars ever made.
You said 1968, right?
In 1968. In order to satisfy the sanction, or the NHRA sanction rules, Dodge produced 50 Dart 426 Hemi cars, which were sent to get the 426 engines installed. So this car featured a fiberglass hood, lightweight steel, thinner glass, and front fenders in an effort to reduce the weight. And the 1968 Dodge Dart was meant to be a race car, which wouldn't be driven on the streets, which is why the weight reduction and the improvements made more sense, for a track environment than city driving. So this was really, devised for, for racing rather than, your dad taking it out on Sunday to bring back the ice cream.
Well, I know the Dart has a devoted following, but I never thought of it as a particularly attractive car.
Well,
but,
this one, the Dodge Dart 420, wasn't even, a lot of times, it wasn't legal on the streets, just depending.
I mean, you're naming these things, I'm Googling the image of the car.
Yeah. So it needed only 10 seconds to hit the quarter mile runs with absolutely no modifications, just straight out of the factory. So whether you believe it's number one or not, most people agree that it was one of the fastest factory-made cars from the golden age of old school muscle cars. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted pure power, that's what you get. And there's a...
Yeah, there we go. You got it right there. It doesn't look like much like that when you just look at it, right?
Yeah. It was a fun top 10 for me because, we all drive cars, but we're not always into, the specifics. But it does bring back a lot of memories of that time. And thanks for inspiring. It was fun for me to look at.
Yeah. If you guys wanted to know more about cars and these muscle cars and what they do today, because there really is a bit of a market for this, there's a couple of shows you might... Of course, you can always look at the Barrett Jackson auctions, right? They usually have them there.
My grandpa used to watch those all the time. Yeah, some of those cars are just like pristinely beautiful.
There's also another Canadian show. It's a Canadian show. It comes out of the Toronto area, and it's usually on the Business Network. It's called Legendary Motor Car.
Oh.
And it's a father and son dealership they have back there, and that's what they do. They take these old cars, and they restore them, they buy them, and then they sell them out the door, and you see them negotiating with the people and restore them and, take good care, and really, really some fine, fine-looking cars. Mm-hmm. And the reason I said the 1970 Charger is because it's also the 1969 Charger. Remember the Dukes of Hazzard?
Mm-hmm.
That car, right? That car is a legend. And the reason why it's so rare today, if you find a very good one, it's got all the bells and whistles and low mileage, they can easily go up to $2 million.
Wow.
Right. And for a 1970 car, right? 1969, 1970. And the reason they're so rare today is because of that show. Because when they did the Dukes of Hazzard, they were doing these jumps for real.
That's right.
But when the car lands, it doesn't keep going. It just crashes.
So they went through a few of them.
They went through lots of them, right? They had to repaint them and all that, and they went through lots and lots of these cars.
Well, that's, speaking of which, that's what's fun watching, channels like the Me channel, when you see all of these old shows that were made in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Part of the real fun of watching those shows, they're two fun things, the fashions and the cars, and it really is just, you're listening to the script and you're listening to the plot, but just watching...
The
way people dressed and the cars that they drove at that
first
time.
First thing that came to mind was like Grease with John Travolta, right?
And the hairdos.
The hairdo and the fashion and the cars, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, my dear Kirsten, you got another brilliant moment for us?
I sure do.
Brought to you by religion.
Okay, so we all know about Hurricane Dorian.
Oh, yes, we do.
And who do we know that loves a good hurricane?
The swishy lady.
Yeah. It's been a while.
All right, so this is what she has to say about what amazing things they did with the hurricane.
This is Kat Kerr, by the way. For our audience, I might not have followed the show on this.
Yes.
Kat Kerr. The prophetess, Kat Kerr. With her swishy stick.
Self-proclaimed.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes. They're all self-proclaimed prophetess and prophets.
Here's what she says. Thank you, Jesus. We crushed the storm together.
What?
Shortly before 8 p.m. Eastern, live from the coast of Florida, we took the authority Christ gave us and declared over the storm. Winds have dissipated from 185 miles per hour to 130, and soon the storm will officially be downgraded to a Category 3, and we will continue to speak against it.
What?
Thank you all who declared with us. As said when we last hit it, we don't fight against the storm, but rule over it as manifested sons and daughters of God. We have been praying for all those who were in the path of the storm in Puerto Rico and the Bahamas, and will continue to do so. Weathermen cannot explain what has happened because the eye is unstable. It is wobbling and moving backward. Also, it has parked. It is a sitting target to be crushed because we are joint heirs with Christ and have given our lives to him. As the word says, we will rule with him.
Jesus Christ. As we are recording this, Hurricane Dorian is actually licking the coast of Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
It's going to kind of hit tonight as we're recording this. So also, I don't know where she realized that the storm is still there. It didn't dissipate at all.
It's also really bad for a storm to slow down too much. Because then it sits on one spot and they get too much rain, and that's when you get massive flooding.
So is it her fault that it stalled over the Bahamas? Was there just too much swishy authority going on?
Swishy authority. Oh, you know, actually, right now, they're actually evacuating part of Halifax.
Yeah.
Yeah. So stay away from the water, obviously, and there's going to be, like, sustained wind of 150 kilometers an hour, is what they're saying.
Wow.
Yeah, it's still strong. It's still very powerful.
It's been a really strange storm.
But, it's known to affect Alabama. That's something else entirely.
Yeah, that's all you need is a Sharpie to make Sharpie. Sure it doesn't affect Alabama.
Sharpie NATO instead of Sharknado. Yeah.
The National Weather Service backtrack a little bit to back Trump up, weren't they? You kind of
did
wonder.
They?
No.
They said
no.
Something about the original. Didn't they say something about, well, 3 or 4, 5, 6 days before it?
No, that was what Trump said.
No, well, I know well, that, but
yeah,
I think
but
the
do,
weather...
When you do long-term prediction, they kind of make it wide because you don't exactly know. As the days are getting closer, then the prediction becomes more and more accurate, obviously.
Well, yeah. We'll have to look that, because somewhere I saw that the weather system... I mean, the weather service said something to kind of soften what Trump had said, and I thought... Forget it. You don't do that.
Well, you gotta remember also the head of the weather service has actually been appointed by Trump as well, as one of his ardent supporters, and I can't remember the guy's name. But anyway, we're way off the subject here. So, swishy lady.
I can't even finish the last little bit here. It's just so ridiculous, and Jesus, and it's like, seriously, with, like, at this point, what I've seen is at least 43 people have died from this, with hundreds, if not thousands, still missing. And the hurricane has left behind billions of dollars of damage.
It's a good thing she's there, because otherwise it'd be tens of billions of dollars of damage.
But, like, absolutely. You guys crushed that storm.
Yeah, sure. Totally
crushed
that storm. And it's also, was it that presidential candidate that came out? What's her name? Williamson? Marianne Williamson?
Marianne Williamson.
And she came out and basically said that we shouldn't mock people that have faith that they can turn away the storm with their faith or something like that. Something ridiculous like that. So, yeah, you were doing so good there, dear.
Okay, we won't mock her.
No, we will.
Much.
There you go.
All right, anything else you have for us?
No, just fuming over, you guys are so stupid.
Fair enough. So let's take a quick pause, and when we come back, we'll be with Dell on Earth, and we'll be talking about food myth and all that kind of stuff. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm God. And I just wanted to make sure to tell you not to listen to Unapologetics on Stitcher and SoundCloud. That's Unapologetics with an X at the end. But, definitely do not listen to this show. I mean, I swear to me, I will murder my son. I kind of already did that, but just don't listen to the show, okay? Hey, Lucy.
Can you not call me that, okay? We already went over what my name is, okay? It's Lucifer.
All right, look, Luce. You want to come with me? I'm going to go fuck with this guy, Joe.
No, don't do that, okay? Can you just leave him alone?
Yeah, I'm going to kill his family.
No, don't do that.
I'm going to give him sores all over his body.
Don't do that. That's disgusting.
And, I'm going to kill all of his livestock.
Stop saying things. Just stop.
And I'm going to blame the whole thing on you. all right, let's go, bud. Remember, don't listen to Unapologetics on Stitcher and SoundCloud.
Hey, definitely listen to that show. It's awesome. It's really cool. He's really a dick.
I heard that.
I'm Amy with a Y.
And I'm Amy with an I.
And we're the hosts of Secular Soup, where each week we offer up a bowl of real talk about atheism, feminism, politics, parenting, and whatever else we want to talk about because it's our podcast.
Just listen to what these random dudes are saying about our show.
This is what would happen if Daria and Jane grew up and started a podcast.
So if you like extremely foul-mouthed ladies with opinions, this is the podcast for you.
Grab a bowl and taste the magic. Slurp even this.
And we have to realize that we are in a situation where people are flying planes into our buildings because they think God wrote their book and that they're going to get to paradise by dying in the right circumstances. And it seems to me a point of really exquisite obviousness that the response to this situation cannot be, sorry guys, God wrote our book and you're going to hell.
Next guest is going to be talking food with us. So we got Dell on Earth with us, as she's a high snappy dresser and a snazzy dancer. Dell, thank you so much for joining us at Lefton Valley.
Thank you. Yeah, I will endorse the snazzy dresser part. Dancing is unclear.
Take the credit where you can and go with it, girl.
It's actually part of the canon here. You cannot be come on the show unless you're a good snappy dresser and snazzy dancer.
Well, geez, what the hell are the rest of us doing here?
That's because we can do it. That's why our guests need to be able to.
That's why we're on podcasting exactly. And not on YouTube.
That's why we have a Facebook radio.
That's right.
Speak for yourself. I'm gorgeous.
Oh, Jesus.
You are.
All right. My dear, maybe you'd be so kind to give us a quick bio for our audience as to who you are and what your show is all about.
Yeah, so I'm Dell on Earth, and I just decided to start a podcast because, well, I was dreaming about it for a few years because it seems to me like the skeptical community in general is really on board with technology in so many aspects of our lives. But when it comes to agricultural technology, they get a little more nervous. And when it comes to food animal agriculture technology, they're just totally back with the general population. And I think there's a lot of really, really interesting and cool and exciting technology out there, and a lot of myths that need busting out there too. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be able to provide that perspective. I myself am a dairy farmer.
Oh. Hey!
I know you guys have your own dairy farmers.
I actually work on a dairy farm as well.
There we go. Something in common.
I have to say, I'm not like a regular listener of the show, but I've listened to a few episodes here and there, and I definitely caught the dairy farmer part. And
you're not a regular listener of the show?
Not every month.
It was nice having you on board. Thank you so
much. Oh, come on, Kevin.
Wait, don't do that to a dairy farmer.
Exactly. So your show focuses a lot. I'm assuming you have probably a field day going out there because there are so many myths about food and what we eat and what we, you know, how we should eat and things like that. Because we do have a great relationship with food, right, as a species.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me something. Which are your biggest pet peeves about what people believe about food?
Well, I mean, just generally, there's this sort of thought that, like, any sort of progress in animal agriculture is scary, which is just totally wild to me. It's so the opposite of how our community feels about technology and progress in all these other areas. And so it's just bizarre to me that somehow we've all still bought the myth that, like, the farms of the 50s were better for animals.
Yeah.
No,
it's true. I mean, even when you look at the package of, you know, even a package of bacon or something like that, you have this low farm, you know, and the green pastures and the rolling hills, you know. So it's true that, you know, we like to, I don't know, lie to ourselves.
Yeah, well, and we're just, like, so fooled. You know, we're so good at, like, dropping the emotional attachment and seeing through the bullshit marketing with a lot of things. But when it comes to animal agriculture, it just seems like skeptics are just, like, pulled in just like everybody else, which is, you know, the first time I ever learned that skepticism was a thing was only, like, 2 years ago. Mm. And it was from the podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Oh, and the very first episode I downloaded and listened to, they were talking about They were going on a big rant about how anti-GMO is ridiculous, and they were very pro-GMO. And I was like, oh my God, these are my people. I love it so much.
So how did you...
That's what really brought me into skepticism. But then when it comes to animals, it's like, just go back to the same old myths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did you develop this interest in food, and what encouraged you to do some more research and become, you know, more of an expert on it?
Well, so I didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up with like extended family that farms, like grandparents and aunts and uncles, but they all lived like 4 or 5, 6 hour drives away. So I'd only get to visit like on holidays and stuff. And my mom got me involved in some youth programs with cattle, and I just really fell in love with them. And then a bunch of people told me that girls couldn't farm, and that people that didn't grow up on farms would never be able to farm. And I was like, screw all of you. I'm going to prove you all wrong. So I did. I got my own farm when I was 25. That was 5 years ago, is when I quit my day job to start milking my own cows. And I kind of grew up with a complex that like farm kids knew everything and I didn't know anything. And so I just absolutely busted my butt trying to learn every possible thing I could. Cause I was so paranoid that everybody else like had some magical knowledge that I didn't have. So I have a degree, I have a 4-year degree in animal science. And then I also have a 4-year degree in philosophy, just cause I really like learning and talking and thinking about stuff.
I'm really impressed.
My farm blew up in my face. So, I mean, I'm still milking cows, but only barely. And I had to go back to work full time as well. So I'm doing both. And so I'm working in agricultural animal research for a full-time job too.
Nice.
So
that's fabulous. Good on you.
Yeah. I there's so many questions I want to ask you first of all, because I was always told, you know, from people in the financial sector that acquiring a farm for somebody who is not, like I said, the child of a farm, or somebody who doesn't have umpteen degrees in agriculture, is nearly impossible. Banks have a tendency not to want to loan money to somebody who's buying a farm. Was that your experience in the U.S.?
Well, it depends a little bit. So particularly in dairy, it is a lot harder in Canada. Like it's a lot closer to impossible because of the quota system that you guys have. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., it's not as bad, but it's still pretty difficult. Like, people do it. Do they do it and are still successful and have a farm 5 years later? Mm-hmm. No. And I am doing exactly that. So.
Wow. Do you find there's so we can go through so many farm myths and food myths here. We could talk to you for the next 2 hours, I'm sure.
Yep. Yeah.
I've got so many questions. You're obviously familiar with some of the Canadian practices as well. Do you know what would be the big differences you would know between our American farmers and the Canadian farmers, you figure?
Well, in dairy, excuse me, I'm recovering from a little cold. In dairy specifically, so Canada has a quota system that means that there's only so much milk that can be produced in Canada, and farmers have to buy shares of that production. So that like doubles the amount of debt, like into the millions of dollars, even just for a small dairy farm to start in Canada. But what that does is it restricts supply, and that keeps the prices of milk fairly reasonable for farmers to be able to have some kind of income in Canada. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the U.S., production is totally a free-for-all. You can make as much as you want. And what happens when you make a ton of something? The price goes down. Mm-hmm. So we have very little income in Canada, or very little income from our milk compared to Canadian farmers, but we don't have to take on the debt of a quota system. But what that also means is that our milk price is just like wildly fluctuating all the time, which makes it really difficult to survive what's going on.
So how many cows did you start out with, and how many do you have now that gives you that balance of being able to make a profit, if you are making a profit, and to handle this, you know, in a way that that fits your knowledge and where you want to go?
So I was milking 60 cows at sort of my full size. Mm-hmm. I have never made 1 cent of profit in 5 years.
Wow.
So 2014 was a record good year for milk prices, and I got in at the tail end of that. So I never actually saw the good milk price, and then it crashed because the European Union used to also have a production quota like mm-hmm. Canada, and they eliminated it in 2014. Mm. So the world supply of milk went up drastically and crashed the price. Wow. And it has stayed crashed since then.
So if you had some say in your American government and you could actually switch the American system to something more like the Canadians do, would you actually think it's a better system, or would you prefer to keep it the way it is?
Well, it would be better than our system. Mm. I don't know if it's the perfect system, because in the scheme of things for the world, is limiting the amount of food that we're allowed to produce so that food stays expensive really a great idea from a world's perspective?
No, fair enough. Fair enough.
You know what I mean? Like, it's always competing interests, like, for farmers to be able to make money, but for people to be able to afford food. Like, those are things that you need to balance. But until 2017, Canada did a really good job of just making only the amount of milk that they needed to use and not really bothering anybody else. Like, they made milk, Canadians drank the milk, and that was kind of the end of story. They were just sort of self-sufficient.
Canadians are usually very protective of their milk industry as well. I mean, I know for a while that they've just opened up the market to American milk products. I should say milk, not necessarily milk products. And I know a lot of Canadians are saying, no, I'm not buying American milk. I'm keeping it with Canadian milk. So maybe we should, just to compare, how much is the price of a gallon of milk in the States worth right now?
It's highly regional. I mean, around here you can get a gallon of milk for like $1.50, but I hear on the coast it's like $4.
Okay, $4 on the coast. Wow.
I know.
That's what we're paying right now, $4 for a gallon.
I know in Bellingham, Washington, where I do a lot of shopping, a quart of milk can go anywhere from $1.27 to $1.47. It's very low. I don't know what, I never buy a gallon, but I buy by the quart.
Yeah. That's why a lot of Canadians have a tendency to just jump across the border and buy it.
Why would you
Costco.
Do that? Our milk's so much nicer.
Yeah. Well, that's another good question. That's another good question. How do you feel about the regulations as to the quality of milk in the States? I know, for example, you guys are allowed to inject cows with RGBH. Do you think that's a good thing?
Which does absolutely nothing to milk quality.
Really?
Even Canada's government says it does nothing to milk quality, and they banned it on animal welfare grounds, which was also BS, but it was mostly just a protectionist move.
So the RGBH, to make sure the audience understands, is essentially a growth hormone for the cow to produce more milk, essentially, correct here? Yeah, and it has no impact on the quality of the milk, is what you're saying?
Nope, none.
Interesting.
So if you look at Canada's official documents back in, whatever year they decided that they were not going to approve it, I think it was the late 90s, mid 90s maybe. Yeah. So even the Canadian government documents said that it doesn't do anything to the milk, and they just banned it because they thought there was a possibility that it increased the rates of mastitis in cows.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is an udder infection, yeah.
So if you don't make a profit, or milk, I don't want to too personal, but if milk, if dairy farmers are not making a profit, how are they getting by year after year without having, that cushion or that amount of money that they can put away or put back into the business? How do dairy farmers survive this?
I mean, well, we're going bankrupt at a rate of 10% of the United States' farms every few months now.
Jesus.
Oh, gosh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not good.
No,
but so the number of cows is staying about the same, though, because those cows are really cheap. So people who are just getting into the business can buy them. Or what it is mostly is it's big dairies continuing to expand. So so the milk price right now is right about break even. If you were like a really big dairy, you could about break even right now. And also the banks have so much invested in those really big dairies that they will keep loaning them money because they're like too big to fail.
Yep.
So they'll keep loaning them money with the hope that the milk price is going to turn around at some point here, which it should. I mean, that's what we thought 4 years ago. I mean, this is fairly unprecedented for it to be this low for this long. So everybody's that can hold on is trying to hold on, hoping they can make it until the turnaround.
Yeah.
So what do you think needs to happen on a political level, or I should say maybe on a regulatory level, for American farmers to get back to being able to actually make a bit of money and actually survive? Instead, like 10% of these farms per month, that's awful. That's an awful, awful number.
It's not going to happen. I mean, there's no fixing it. It's snowballed to the point that there's no fixing it. So this happened in the 70s to the poultry industry in the United States, and it happened in the early 90s to the pork industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I guess we all knew it was coming in dairy. We just thought maybe we had another 10 or 20 years, and it's here now. So there isn't any stopping it at this point.
So are we envisioning that maybe the U.S. is going to have to import a lot of their food?
Oh, no, no. So we will. So just like with poultry and with pork. So it's all like one giant multinational company, and they will own all of the pigs and all of the pig barns, and they will just write a contract to an employee to manage the farm.
Hmm. So instead of like the family owned farm, it will be a factory farm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's. There isn't going to be, I mean, in order to stop it at this point, you would have to put in some sort of like actual law that was like, you can't own more than one site, or you can't own more than 1,000 cows, and nobody's going to do that. Yeah. I mean,
that's very unlikely to happen too. It just by sheer lobbying.
Right. So it's just not. It's not fixable.
So the little family farm thing is, we can already say it's almost a thing of the past already.
Well, so dairy, well, beef is still holding out, kind of, because beef has sort of segmented itself into the people who raise calves up to about 6 months old, and then the people who raise them from 6 months old on. So there's still a pretty heavy, like, family farm sort of aspect to the beef industry. And then the dairy industry was pretty family owned still. Whereas, you know, pork, poultry, eggs, that's pretty much all the contractor model at this point.
Wow.
I was listening to an interview with Amy Klobuchar the other night, and she was talking about keeping in pretty close touch with the farm industry, the small farmers and the farmers in Minnesota. And what touched me was she said that when she goes to talk to some of these farmers, you know, to find out what she can do and to learn a little bit more about what's going on, she said a lot of times when they sit down to talk and they close the door, she said they just start to cry about the conditions and, you know, how difficult it is to maintain, you know, a living. And she seems like such a sincere person. You know, I wonder whether or not, you know, what she's saying now that she's on the campaign trail is what your experience may be and what she's trying to do for the Minnesota farmers. Are you involved in any part of that?
Well, I mean, I guess I haven't really heard any talk from her about agriculture hardly at all. I know Kristen Gillibrand had made sort of a token effort to help dairy farmers specifically before she announced her run for president, but it was recently, it was in like the last year. So I kind of had my eye on her. But yeah, I mean, I just get the sense that Amy Klobuchar, you know, does generally keep a good handle on the concerns of farmers. So that's just, you know, I just have generally good feelings about her more than I have like specific examples of things that she's done or not done.
There's been a lot of talk lately in the news about farmers essentially revolting against Trump, especially due to his tariffs war. Do you feel that that's actually justified? Do you think that's overblown? Or are actually farmers really, really feeling the pinch?
Well, I'm pretty hooked into the dairy farmer community specifically, so it's a little harder to generalize to everything. So the only data that I've been able to find, because farmers were historically Democratic voters, and they were mostly because they want to be hooked in with good government support programs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What really started to turn farmers away from Democrats was environmental policies. Because the issue with environmental policies is, well, it's kind of a lose-lose situation, because what happens is Democrats want to put in good environmental protections, and then Republicans want to make sure that there's no money to spend on the project of the environmental protection, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So what happens is if you get Democrats in charge, they pass laws. So like in Minnesota, our Democratic governor passed a law saying that you couldn't plant any crops within 50 feet of any waterway. So what happens is, I'm sure if Democrats had been in charge of everything, they would have offered us some assistance or some incentive to implement that thing that which was going to be extremely expensive for us. But because Republicans were in charge of the House and Senate, they made sure that the law could get passed, but they wouldn't put any money towards it. So what that means is you have a new environmental law that farmers have to follow, and we have no money by which to follow it. So the environmental stuff is the main thing that turns farmers off from Democrats. So that's the main thing that farmers are afraid of when they're afraid of voting blue. But it just, there's a lot of other things that Democrats do that are very helpful to farmers. So it's really not so cut and dried which direction we're going to go. So anyway, I did some research, and there's only one actual poll that's available about whether or not farmers supported Trump. And this was taken in October before the election. And what it found was that 55% of farmers supported Trump. And that was before the election, before he put in all of these ridiculous trade policies. And it's most certainly dropped since then. But the other thing about that poll is it was a really, really, really terribly done poll. It only included grain farmers.
Really?
It excluded almost any farmer in any blue state. It excluded pretty much any farmer under the age of 40. And the way that they did that, I'm generalizing, the way that they did that is they said any farmer that owns less than 200 acres isn't really a farmer. So I'm generalizing from that rule that any farm under 200 acres, that's going to be most of your farms in blue states. That's going to be any livestock farm. That's going to be any fruit or vegetable farm. That's going to be any young farmer.
And you know, so they structured the poll to absolutely fit the Republican base. You know, they found out where the Republican farmers were and their age and all the demographics and said, okay, we'll structure the poll to give weight to them and the heck with everybody else. So
and it, they it still was, only PR, found it was PR, it's not a poll. So that was really shocking to me because I thought, oh, I bet it's like 60-40. And it was only 55% support in the most biased sample they could find. So I'm really, really pissed off by this narrative that farmers support Trump, because it appears to have never really been true that there's any kind of overwhelming support for Trump among farmers. And the problem is people are conflating rural with farmer. Farmers are like less than 5% of the rural population. So like when you say rural people, 95% of who you're talking about are have nothing to do with farming.
Well, Republicans seem to fuel themselves on myths and lies, so that kind of goes along with, you know, with everything we've been talking about.
So let's switch gears here, because we're turning this into a whole bunch of politics.
I think this is fantastic.
It is. But, you know, her show is not necessarily geared towards politics as well.
Well, Del, you're just going to have to come back and talk about food.
Tell me about how much time do you bang your head against the wall when you have to start talking about GMOs?
Okay, so interestingly, the community is really good about GMOs. So, like, because I'm mostly targeting people that are already skeptics, GMOs isn't that big of an issue, which is nice because plant agriculture isn't really my area of expertise. So, I mean, I love learning about it and talking about it, but I have to do a lot more. It's not exactly low-hanging fruit. Like, I have to do a lot of research to be able to speak authoritatively about it. But, yeah, the skeptic community is pretty good about understanding that GMOs are not a boogeyman. So the aim, or the sort of the direction that I want to take with GMOs, is I want to be able to put out some episodes that are specifically like, let's learn about the GMO papaya in Hawaii and how it saved Hawaii's papaya industry. Isn't this a cool technology story? If that makes sense. And just like sort of drum up some excitement about all the cool technology that we have. Whereas on the animal agriculture side, I'm more interested in kind of myth busting. But I don't have to do so much work to do myth busting when it comes to GMOs. in the skeptical
area. Yeah. Well, do you have any idea by any chance how much of your audience is actually, I'm assuming most of your audience is like us, as skeptics and atheists and all that, but I'm sure your show also appeals to people that are outside the movement.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just kind of who I've been targeting. And obviously, I mean, I only have like 4 episodes up, so it's not like I can make a broad statement about my gigantic audience or anything. Because I'm really in a position where like I have so many ideas of what I want to talk about, but I really want to put the work in to make sure I don't say anything incorrect and make sure I get like a full picture of everything. So I do a lot of research for the episodes. And I've just been, since I took this full-time job 6 months ago, I've just been just unbelievably busy.
We understand that all too well.
So with GMOs not being a massive hurdle for the
skeptic community,
what have you found has been the thing that a lot of skeptics believe that is false and that you're just like, really, guys? Come on.
Anything to do with animal agriculture, pretty much. I mean, they seem to have figured out that like organic is bullshit, whether we're talking about like organic agriculture for animals or for plants. And it's been really interesting to hear that skeptics know that organic agriculture is bullshit, but they don't seem to understand that organic animal agriculture literally is just giving homeopathy to your cows.
I'm curious about that. Would you like to elaborate on that? I've never heard that that comparison.
Organic agriculture for animals bans any substance that's considered unnatural. So like the whole point of organic agriculture is the appeal to nature fallacy. Like that is what the rules are built on. You cannot give antibiotics to an animal if you have an organic farm.
What?
Yeah, so you can only do like homeopathic herbal remedies.
Oh, those poor cows.
So, but here's how they try to get around the animal welfare implication. They do say that if the cow is like going to die, you can give her antibiotics and then immediately sell her to someone else.
Oh,
but I think we can imagine what sort of incentive system that sets up for actually treating your cows.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to buy a sick cow. Like, you're obviously going to wait until the last minute because you're incentivized to, like, you're not thinking about the animal's well-being. You're thinking about, will she live if I don't give her this antibiotic? Because I'm only going to give her the antibiotic if I have no other options whatsoever. And, of course, it's what you're going to do before that time is you're going to give money to every single product that comes across your radar that's an herbal oregano supplement, and you're going to put it up your cow's udder in hopes that it cures her udder infection, which is ridiculous.
Whoa, really? I had no idea about that. I'm running here. I had no idea. To my great shame, for years, and this is like, of course, probably over a decade ago, but for years I was one of these anti-GMO proponents. My great shame, I actually admit that. Of course, I did learn more into the subject, but for the longest time, I couldn't understand the idea of, you know, why are you inserting fish gene into this apple? You know, it didn't make much sense to me because, you know, on the surface, like you said, the natural fallacy, right? Why are you putting fish genes in an apple?
Nature's stupid sometimes. Look at our eyesight.
It's when you learn a bit more about genetics, it's just like, it's just genes. It doesn't matter if it's a fish gene or an apple gene or whatever, it's just genes. Then you start to understand. So maybe as a for the layman listener, like one of our listeners that's hearing you for the first time and all that, what bit of advice would you give him about when it comes to learning about scientific facts about food?
I think the biggest thing is just to know that, generally speaking, people are choosing to use technologies because it is helpful. Like, you know, there's this weird myth that, like, we're all being forced to buy our GMO this or that. Generally speaking, it goes for any agricultural technology that, like, if farmers are buying it, they're probably buying it because it's helpful to them in some way. And usually that means it's helping us get more food out of less product, like less land, less cows. And any of that is going to come with some environmental good. If you can get more food from less land, that's usually a good thing. Now, obviously, we have to do it carefully and make sure there's not any side effects. But for the most part, we need to be thinking about getting more food out of less input if we want to be able to feed everyone and if we want to be able to do it in an environmentally friendly manner. And of course, technologies all come with trade-offs. So if you decide that you don't want to use antibiotics, you have to realize that that means you're going to have, say, 15% higher death loss in your herd of cattle, right? So that means more environmental impact for the same amount of food. So if we go, if we're going to take any technology and rule it out, like, it's going to come with downsides. So everything, there's always two sides of the coin, if that makes sense.
You find you get into a lot of the what I call the boogeyman symptom. You know, people are talking online, but they talk about big pharma, they talk about big agriculture. And, you know, I mean, this week I was having a debate with somebody that was insisting that food companies like Kraft and Pepsi are actually using aborted fetuses, a sample, as food additives.
What?
Yeah, as food additives for flavoring to change your DNA. I said, okay, there's so many things wrong with that statement, man. I don't even know where to start. You know,
oh my God.
I know this is the state of the of people today, and I think of course it's the whole Dunning-Kruger effect, right? They think they know more because, you know, Karen did a 5 minutes of research on some websites called Natural News.
So. Yeah, well, and it's amazing how much that affects, you know, even into the skeptic community with certain things, as this sort of Dunning-Kruger effect of, you know, I've read a lot of think pieces about it, therefore I know how it works. You know.
Yeah.
Well, it's also hard to separate different things. I was just having a conversation on Facebook the other day about someone saying that grass-fed cattle are bad because it requires clear-cutting of the forest, like what's happening in the Amazon. And, like, that's definitely true. If you want to graze cows in Brazil, well, in the Amazon region of Brazil, you would have to cut down the forest and plant grass to graze your cows. But in most of the United States, we already have a prairie biome. So, like, you're not, like, it's already a grassland landscape. Yeah. So grazing cattle on it is not, like, that's actually in harmony with the natural biome to graze natural prairies. Like, that's how it should work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes
so it's hard to explain that, like, in New Zealand, they do it this way, but in the United States, they do it this way. And what's harmful in this place is actually fine here. And unfortunately, that just means there's no easy answers to anything. Like, okay, so the answer is that organic is bullshit, but what does that mean you should buy? Well, I don't have a good answer for you.
It just means you need to really learn about your sources and encourage a small farmer in your community.
Well, and if you can talk to individual farmers, you can try to sort of figure out if what you're buying aligns more with what the science says. But most of the folks that are going to be selling on a small scale in a farmer's market are actually going to be very deep in the organic woo. So
I get that. But, you know, sometimes, like, you have to understand also, I think a lot of people, sometimes I'm willing to cut him some slack because, for example, I was talking to my chicken guy. Yes, I have a chicken guy. And he farms his chicken right here on the Massapequa Flats there. And he says to me he used to work for Safeway at the same time. Right? And he stayed at Safeway because Safeway is a branch of grocery stores that's closing down here. He stayed there because he was getting a pension. But he says to me, he says, Kev, you wouldn't imagine what goes on with the chicken at Safeway. He says it's actually grown in Argentina. It's actually shipped to China and processed there, and then it's sold here.
Ew.
And, you know, and
that sounds fairly surprising.
Well,
I guess
it does.
I have to look into it.
This is my chicken guy, right? And you're thinking, oh, well, you know, for the layperson, said I wouldn't want to call him a liar, and why would I do so, right? And he's got a small poultry farm where he grows.
I'm just surprised that would make any economic sense when, like, the United States has massive amounts of chicken ready to export. It seems weird that they would do all that.
I thought so too, but I'm putting myself in the boots of, you and I are skeptics, and we're thinking like that. But the average person out there doesn't really put that much thought into it, right?
Right.
So
they
probably say, "Oh my God, what a horrible thing." And right. Is he doing that just to sell his chicken, or is he actually right, or is he misinformed himself? No.
Well, either way, it certainly seems like he believes it and is sincere. It's possible that happens.
Exactly. Sure. So I guess, you know, we have to keep listening to shows like yours to debunk all this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I'm kind of trying to keep stuff to, like, describing the food systems in the U.S. a little bit, just because otherwise the scope just gets totally crazy. But, you know, it's still really interesting. And when it comes to a lot of stuff, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the Canadian food system and the U.S. food system. I mean, they're not all that different a lot of the time. So
yeah, exactly. So, Del, in conclusion there, for the average person out there listening, if they want to learn more about their food, where would you tell them to start? Where can they get informed, besides listening to your show, of course?
Yeah. Well, when it comes to the plant food side, there's a lot of really good resources out there. I'm trying to think of them. Like BioFortified is a resource that's been around for a long time, trying to do some good pro science work on the GMO front. There's a fair number of things out there. It doesn't seem like anybody is doing any sort of pro science work in the animal agriculture space at all, honestly. If anybody knows of anybody, absolutely, I would love to check it out, because hey, maybe that's a shortcut and I don't have to do all this original research myself. But it seems like no matter where you turn, everybody's got some kind of woo they're buying into on the animal agriculture front, which is just, it's just baffling to me, because it's such a strange blind spot to have, but it seems to be there. So I don't know. I'm sorry. That sounds kind of depressing.
No, I totally get it.
I'm the one that knows what's going on. It just seems like people aren't talking about it.
Well, Del, the topic that we went off on a tangent was so fascinating. It was almost as though we planned the program around everything that we discussed today. Will you please come back and talk more about evidence-based science-based food? This has just been an enlightening, fascinating. Yeah, it's just been a fascinating conversation, and you're such a good advocate, you know, of what you're doing. We'd love to have you come back and spend some time with us, you know, going over some of the research that you've done.
Yeah, and you and Christina can go and milk some cows together.
Yeah,
that'd be
there
great.
You go.
Yeah, Christina, can I ask you a little bit about the farm you work at?
Oh, 100%.
How many cows?
Well, we have a couple hundred being milked, but then there's there's like the
three
new cow, like there's the calves that get rotated like back into the system. So then we have like the ones that are just like babies, teenagers. So probably in total, maybe like, oh gosh, definitely around like 500.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's a pretty nice farm for Canada, isn't it? So in the U.S., that'd be like a smallish average size, but in Canada, that's pretty big, isn't
it? I'd say medium size.
Okay.
And what kind of cow?
Oh,
The numbers I've seen are like that the average farm size in Canada is about 90 milk cows.
Oh, really?
I don't really interact with a lot of other milkers, so I have no idea.
Okay.
Well, you don't have a milker guild somewhere?
No. Well, this is the only farm I've milked.
They all walk into the bar. They all have a glass of milk at the end of the day.
It's definitely on the bigger side than, because like driving down like anywhere in the country, like you do see a lot of smaller farms.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Because the farm I work at, they've been there for like, oh gosh, like 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been able to build up. And they make a lot of profit, so like they've been able to like build a nice big house.
Oh, are they
for the grandparents?
Cows?
No, they're the black and white ones.
The Holstein.
Holstein, yeah.
Holstein.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the name of that one that looks like a panda?
Yeah, Del, we are in an agricultural dairy farm area.
Yeah.
I've heard you guys talk about it on the podcast. Seems
probably
like you're pretty rural.
Yes.
Well, we're just on the edge of rurality here. You know, as soon as you get out of Abbotsford is like half city, half rural. There's 150,000 here, so
yeah.
You know, it's just on the edge of that.
We are the city in the country, as it were.
Yes, yeah, it smells like cow poo all the time.
It does. You know when you've reached us when you start smelling all the farms.
Yeah, and
better cow than pig.
Actually,
oh God, yes.
Or chicken.
And we're right on the
U.S. border,
the Canadian U.S. border, and the state of Washington, and going immediately south into Linden, toward Bellingham, they have the same.
A lot of Dutch.
They have the same type of agriculture there, and a lot of dairy farms as well. So we're definitely in the zone here.
All right. Well, Del, thank you so much for joining us today. I really, really appreciate that. But this is your time. Be shameless. Plug yourself. Plug your show. If people want to find out more about your wacky adventures, where can they find you?
So on Facebook, I'm Del on Earth. I'm sure you'll have like a link, or you'll spell my name somewhere, right?
Yeah, yes.
And my podcast is called Evidence-Based Eating. I toyed with really creative names for a while, and then I was like, how about I just say what I want to talk about? Yes. so I just settled on evidence-based eating, has some alliteration going on, and I can be reached on Gmail. It's ev-based eating, so just ev-based eating. That's kind of how I shorten it up. I'm on Twitter at More Cowbell, M-O-A-R, C-O-W-B-L-L-E. So, yeah, those are some places to reach me. I pretty open. So I started a whole new Facebook account when I started sort of doing all this activist work under a pseudonym for many reasons. Kind of want to keep my atheism and my queerness separate from my career life. And I kind of want to keep my farm activism separate from bleeding over into my real farm a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just because there are some animal rights groups that are terroristic that have been active in my area. So I'm just trying to keep a little bit of a wall between things. So my Facebook page is really open for anybody that's a fan of the show or interested in talking to me about the show, because that's kind of the purpose of it, is to be me in the skeptical community. So
fantastic. Well, before I let you go, I got to have you say, hey, this is Della on Earth from Evidence-Based Eating, and I took a left in the valley.
Hey, this is Del on Earth from Evidence-Based Eating, and I took a left at the valley.
And that was Del on Earth. And evidence-based eating.
She's great.
She's
great.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I was very, very impressed with her knowledge. My God. And not just her knowledge of her industry as a whole, but the fact that she actually knows about the Canadian side of things.
I know.
And that was great.
I was impressed.
I think she bought it with Christina as well.
Yeah, I'm impressed that
it was fun.
Yeah, at age 14, she knew what she wanted to do.
She's got her
and
shit
cared
together.
For those cows, you know, took care of them and, you know, built her knowledge so that she could, you know, eventually have a farm of her own. That's not an easy task.
No, she's got her manure in line.
That's the thing with farming is, no matter what kind of a day you're having, how sick you are, whether it's snow, rain, sleet, hail, ice, heat, you have to go out and do your job. Yeah. You have to go out and you have to feed the animals and you have to clean after them and everything like that. Like, farming does not stop just because weather or an illness or something like that. Like, you still have to go out and take care of the animals or somebody does.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not always the easiest thing to do.
That's a tough job.
It
never
certainly
been easy.
Is. And we'll have her back, and I'm sure we'll have some more food, really, because we just scratched the surface on something.
We really did.
We really did, so it's going to be interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for listening, and thank you to Del on Earth for being our guest. You can follow us at leftofthevalley.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at LEDV Podcast. You can give us send us an email at theleftatvalley@outlook.com. Give us a 5-star review where you find us. It helps us and helps others find the show, and you can also help the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/LETV. Okay, coming up next week, we'll be talking about The Vanishing of the Bees.
Oh, finally.
That's going to be a very interesting show. See what's going on with bees. It kind of goes well with the agricultural theme show of today.
Yeah, long time.
The week after that, we'll be talking about The Free Thought Prophet with James McGaffick. And we'll also be talking about Everyone's Agnostic with Marie. In October, we'll have a Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy with Mike Bowler. And we'll also have Ask an Atheist with Sam Solvay and The Godless Revolution. And we'll also have it with Dan Ellis. And we'll also have our Halloween special. And in November, we'll be talking to our friend David Fitzgerald. He's coming back on the show.
Great.
And we'll also have Jeff Cohen of Fair talk about media and being unbiased in media. And we'll also have The Brazen Atheist coming as well. Wow.
Ooh,
we're almost getting towards the end of the year already.
Where did the summer... Did we actually have summer?
No, no, it just...
Or did we dream it?
As my father in his wisdom used to say, life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it spins. It's very apt in a way.
Well,
disgusting, but apt.
One thing you could say is we have an utterly fantastic lineup.
Oh. 5 points for that. Well, thank you so much, guys. Until next time. Only true on a regional scale.
Science is universal. Are you to say that horse isn't real? Well, and you know, it's I still feel a little confused about my political identification because I was raised a Republican and then I went through a libertarian phase on my way to being a liberal, so I still don't quite know what to label myself. You know, this election was the first time I'd ever voted for a Democrat, was against Trump. Oh. So
just label yourself common sense intelligent and don't sweat the rest.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm working on, you know. I'm just like, you know, I always say it's not like my goals or my values changed at all. It's just that I realized that the Republicans were just idiots and not actually accomplishing any of the things that they said that they were standing for. And I was like, oh, well, it turns out the people that actually care about the stuff I care about are not them.
Best to keep it on the hush. Don't wanna affect business. He loves money too much. We know that they love the kids, but how the fuck can we protect them while they planning to molest them? We teaching them to respect them. Respect them.
Fuck that.
The system is broke down, working backwards. And the only action or tactic I plan to practice now is to attack them. The parties of God's hands are bloodstained. Millions of murders by believers, and they're all in God's name. And let me take a sec, don't mean to sound so hateful, but I swear to God, pun intended, I find it disgraceful that many atheists are told to be quiet. You're not alone, speak your mind, time to let it be known. I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, and